From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in today for Cynthia Canty. Michigan Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin met yesterday with Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Slotkin wants DeVos to meet with survivors of Larry Nassar.
Have a conversation. If you don't want to talk about specifics, let them just talk about their experience.
And after the Senate passed an auto insurance overhaul yesterday, Lansing is looking more and more like a big old game of political chicken.
The consensus is they're basically going to dare the governor to veto this.
Plus, medieval scholars are descending on Kalamazoo this week. And when it comes to gender equity, turns out there's a lot we can still learn.
So I think what they're going to be surprised about is how relevant, how immediate, how alive these plays seem, despite the fact that they're 1,000 years old.
Those stories and more on Stateside, but first the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in today for Cynthia Canty. On today's show, the politics of overhauling auto insurance in Michigan. Let's just say things are getting interesting in Lansing. But first, Michigan Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin met yesterday with Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Slotkin met with DeVos to encourage her to meet with survivors of former MSU doctor Larry Nassar. Congresswoman, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So you wanted the secretary to meet with the survivors because of DeVos's proposed changes to Title IX that would include how universities and colleges handle sexual assault complaints. How did the meeting go?
Well, first of all, I have to hand it to her that she agreed to the meeting. You know, I had sent her a couple letters. We had reached out to her team. And I thought that that was a stand-up thing to do, to have us to come, you know, have us come to her office and meet face-to-face. I had never met her before, so I really applaud her willingness to do that. You know, for me, it's extremely important for someone who's been making or proposed changes to Title IX, which governs, yes, our universities and colleges, but also K through 12. That before she finalized any changes, she hear from the very people in her home state who went through the experience of Title IX, get their feedback on what it was like dealing with sexual assault on campus. So I was there to urge her to do that. And, you know, I was disappointed that she said she was unable to do that. She gave me kind of a legal answer to that, but if she can meet with me and talk generally about the experience of sexual assault, you know, in and around campus, she should be able to meet with the survivors. And so we talked about that and a bunch of other things.
Your office put out a statement, in fact, saying that it felt sort of like legalese that she was reading to you. Why do you think that was?
Well, I do think they're in the middle of a process to determine, you know, what the adjudicate comments on these proposed changes. They had over 100,000 comments come in to their proposed changes, which to me really ignore the lessons of the Larry Nassar scandal. I think that's where this all started for me, is that her proposed changes really feel like she's willfully ignoring what happened in her home state in such a huge way, making it harder for people to come forward, constraining, you know, the definitions. And it just felt like we were going in the wrong direction. You know, I think that I wished that she would at least agree to have a general conversation about sexual assault on campus and how to improve the safety for, you know, folks in universities, but also K through 12.
And her answer was no.
She just gave me this legal answer that she, you know, for various reasons was unable to formally meet during this process. While the adjudication of the comments is ongoing. But she was able to meet with me, right? She, like I said, she agreed to have a conversation with me about sexual assault. So why couldn't she have the very same conversation with Nassar survivors?
Okay, so the response, as you mentioned, felt kind of legalese. Why do you need to speak in legalities if she's the Secretary of Education? Help me understand that.
Well, she definitely, you know, there is a case to be made. She had three lawyers in the room with her, three folks in the room with her. You know, I think that they're worried about speaking directly about the changes during this comment period. They quoted some regulations that they needed to adhere to that prevented them from talking about the specifics of the proposed changes. But they still took the meeting. And so that's all I'm asking her to do with the Nasser survivors is have a conversation. If you don't want to talk about specifics, let them just talk about their experience. Hear from people who have lived it, what it was like and how to make it better.
You've spoken with many of the survivors. Have you spoken with any of the survivors since you had this meeting with DeVos?
So we made sure that they got the readout from us. And then what we were proposing to do was kind of do a conference call with whoever wanted to jump on from the survivor and activist community, just to let them know not just kind of the headlines, but the details of what we discussed. I mean, another thing that we had a conversation about, which came directly, frankly, from the feedback I got from survivors, was that it's not just about what goes on in campuses, that she, as Secretary of Education, has responsibility for Title IX as it affects K through 12, right? And so we've talked a lot about how, you know, culturally, we need to do more to educate people when they're younger, before they get to campus, about consent sexual assault awareness. And so I asked her to please engage on that, right? She's a leader. She can be a real leader on this by requesting, you know, that K through 12 educators do more to incorporate consent education earlier on, so that we're not putting the onus completely on universities when people finally get there to catch everything, which we know could probably never happen. So we talked about K through 12 education. We also talked about charter school accountability, you know, I mean, separate topic. But I think I hear quite often from my constituents that they're concerned about accountability over the charter schools, particularly those that are taking federal dollars. And they didn't feel like there's the same accountability on them as there is on sort of your local public school. So we talked about a range of issues, and we want to make sure to back brief the survivors.
What did she have to say about that? Of course, she's an incredibly polarizing figure here in Michigan when it does come to charter schools and vouchers.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say we had a real difference of opinion on the charter school issue. And I went into it knowing that.
Sure.
That's not a surprise. But, you know, she, I do not believe that I got to her and that she feels like she has to do anything more on accountability for charter schools. She said that the standards were very clear. They're all being adhered to. I talked about my concerns that certain young people were unable, you know, if you had a disability, you know, it was harder to get into some of these charter schools. The charter schools didn't have a responsibility to educate everyone the same way the public schools are, or the local public schools. And she just, I think we just literally were talking past each other. She has such strong views about charter schools. I have such strong views about accountability, particularly for for-profit charter schools, that we just sort of left the conversation, neither of us moving in any different direction.
Democratic Michigan Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin. She met yesterday with Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Congresswoman, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Now, after we spoke with Representative Slotkin, we received a statement from the Department of Education. It reads, quote, Representative Slotkin needs to stop using Nasser's heinous crimes as banter for a press release. By all accounts, from those in the room, this hyperbolic press release does not reflect the actual tone or tenor of yesterday's meeting. Please make sure your reporting includes the fact that we have two investigations involving these survivors, and it would be inappropriate for the secretary to meet with anyone during the open investigation stage. Schools across the state say Michigan lawmakers need to regulate e-cigarettes and help keep them out of the hands of minors. But there's a dispute over how to do that. Michigan Radio's Shayna Roth reports.
Feels good. That jacket makes it better. What?
It's almost lunchtime at Belding High School, east of Grand Rapids, and you don't even really have to check the clock to tell. You can smell it. Fried chicken sandwiches, pizza, curly fries, the salivating scents linger in the halls until you get to the bathroom. That smells like something else.
Nobody home, but definitely a fruity smell. I mean, it's 10 o'clock, we're in the middle of class, and it smells like fruit in that bathroom.
That fruity smell comes from e-cigarettes. Those are devices that people use to inhale a converted vapor, typically liquid nicotine, sometimes with fruity scents. Michael Ostrander is the school principal. He says vaping has become a serious problem here and in high schools across the state. He says staff confiscates vaping tools almost every week, sometimes a dozen in a month. It's even the new currency in schools. Kids trade vaping tools for other things, like help on homework.
We've reached a point where I believe it's an epidemic, and we've waited too long.
Health advocates agree. Andrew Sheppers is with the American Cancer Society. He says the products need to be regulated and treated like tobacco, like they are on the federal level. Sheppers says that would effectively prevent minors from using and protect the public.
We would rather fall on the side of defining them as a tobacco product so that we are trying to provide some protection for the public than kind of piecemealing something together.
But so far, that approach has failed to gain traction in Lansing. So now, lawmakers have introduced bills to ban the use and possession of vaping tools by minors. Republican Senator Rick Outman is a bill sponsor.
I'm just trying to get this out of the hands of kids. That's as simple as it gets. This is a simple bill. It doesn't preclude anything else.
5 years ago, the state legislature sent a similar bill to then-Governor Rick Snyder. Snyder vetoed it because he agreed with health advocates. Democratic Senator Jeremy Moss says he'd like to regulate e-cigarettes like tobacco, but he says there just isn't the political will to do that, in part because the result would be higher taxes.
Let's have that conversation. I was ready to tackle it last session. It didn't move. I'm ready to tackle it this session. Let's see if we can get some movement. But I can't say, you know, that is going to hold up this urgent work right now of making sure minors don't have these vape products.
Back at Belding High School, 14-year-old ninth grader Mitchell Lake says he's sick of that fruity vaping smell.
You can't even go to the bathroom hardly.
Lake says kids are constantly vaping during school. That's despite school policies banning it.
Like, I don't really think it's peer pressure here. I think it's just trying to fit in with groups. Like, there's groups of people that do it, and, like, certain, like say you just want to fit in, then you start doing it.
Meanwhile, teachers and school officials are worried about the potential health implications of vaping, and not just from liquid nicotine. Principal Ostrander says he's heard kids are trying to vape other things as well.
And so now you're inhaling that in a way that your body's not supposed to do that? That's scary. That freaks me out.
But it appears school officials could have to continue to wait for a resolution. Governor Gretchen Whitmer's administration has come out against the bills making their way through the legislature. But a spokesperson says the governor wants to find a, quote, meaningful solution to keep minors from vaping. I'm Shayna Roth at the State Capitol.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. It is Wednesday, and that means it's time for Cindy to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. With the great weather last weekend, a lot of Michiganders were able to get some winter-delayed chores done, like lawn work, garden planting, and perhaps cleaning up that camper trailer. Michiganders have long had an affinity for camper trailers, and it's not a coincidence that the advent of camper trailers and our state park system, which celebrates its 100th birthday later this month, developed almost hand in hand. In fact, a group called Tin Can Tourists celebrates its own centennial this summer. So we're going to talk now about tin can tourism with historian and blogger Mickey Lyons. Welcome back, Mickey. Good to see you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And we have the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark with us. Hey, Rachel.
Hi.
So how long after the automobile came into its own until people started saying, hey, guess what? We can hitch a camper trailer to that rear bumper.
It didn't take long. You know, people are innovative souls. So it was about 1910 that the earliest camper is on record.
That's a lot earlier than I thought it would be. Now, I'm curious, was this an expensive toy for the wealthy, or did camper trailers open up traveling to more people?
Initially, in the 1920s, what people were doing is creating their own campers. They're taking a chassis and then building on top of that. So they're pretty interesting looking. They're very heavy. They're about 8 tons. So that was not exactly the best way to go. And then in the 1930s, you get commercially built campers. And those weren't cheap. They're about $500 to $1,000. So they're affordable for some, but not for everybody.
I would guess so. Mickey, I'm hearing 8 tons. That was a ponderous thing to haul along behind your car.
For sure, especially if you consider the condition of the roads at the time.
Tell us about Tin Can Tourists. I know they're marking their centennial this year.
Right. So this group started in 1919 as a group in Florida, based out of DeSoto, Florida, and then they moved to Tampa. And they were just essentially a group of, I would say, middle class, middle income folks who had some time on their hands. Most of them were between 50 and 65. So kids are gone, off to school. So they are, just like I'm sure many of us are by now, sick of the cold. So they go down to Florida, a lot of them from Michigan, and they winter in Florida in the summer. And then they make the trek, which could take about 2 weeks on the roads at the time, back up to Michigan and spend the summers in Michigan.
Yeah, no spiffy I-75 to whip you up and whip you down.
Yeah.
So what was it like? Dixie Highway, certainly. We all know if you live in Southeast Michigan, you've heard of Dixie Highway. Tell
us
about that.
Right. So Dixie Highway, you know, was a result, obviously, of the automobile and as well these campers that really took advantage of that road. This is the days before motels. So, you know, they got called, they became the tin can tourists because they ate out of tin cans. They would stock up their car with as many tin cans as they could fit in it and then eat alongside of the road. You know, pop a tent, attach strange attachments to the side of their Model T.
How about sleeping?
Sleeping often on the side of the road, depending on the kinds of campers that a lot of them built themselves. Anything from, you know, a self-contained little tiny camper that's room for one bed or a much more luxurious sort of experience, yeah.
Rachel, when did these trailers become enough of a thing, I'm using air quotes here, that Michigan began requiring owners to register them?
So the Public Act 196 of 1905, and I love the wording of this, it's requiring registration for, quote, all vehicles propelled by power other than muscular, unquote. So the law stated in 1905, you had to register any vehicle, essentially not pushed or pulled by human or four-legged animal. And then the expansion of licensing goes into 1919, again in 1929, and then finally one of the final codes is 1949.
All right. So, and I know I grew up in a camping family. We started in the 1960s. And by that point, trailers and campers were a big, big thing. And as we're talking about this and the tin can tourists, which, Mickey, you say it had to do with the tin cans they were carrying.
Right.
Not so much that you have this little tin can pulling behind. So are we talking about trailers? Or we're not talking about tents, are we?
Well, some of the earliest designs were sort of this combination of a tent with a scaffolding built around your existing car. So you would get, you know, an open car, a convertible, essentially,
okay,
and build this pop-out tent around it.
Yeah.
So you've got those, but then you also have wooden and tin and aluminum trailers, like the Airstreams that we're more familiar with.
We had an Apache pop-up,
uh-huh,
and it was the trailer that they had the checklist, and they'd stuff it with all the supplies, and then we would get to the campground, raise the roof, and pull out those beds on either side, and you had your camper. I'm interested in how, when you think of the century, so we are taking it from those early years when it was, you know, a crummy road down,
yes,
south, and there were no rest plazas and no fast food places to stop for the bathroom runs or getting food or any of that. I have to imagine the big push to build interstate highways after World War II really helped camping.
Absolutely, yes. And that's when we sort of start to see, interestingly, almost the golden age of camping, but also as far as the tin can tourists as a group, as a society, sort of starting to filter out because there's so many more different kinds of groups to join. So you lose this coherence as a group while at the same time you have so many more options to go camping and so many different kinds of experiences you can have.
Rachel, I've got to wonder, speaking of the 100th birthday of our state park system, when did the state parks get in on the, hey, let's provide, you know, specified campgrounds, what we know today?
So coming out of World War I, Michigan only had two state parks. So we had Mackinac Island and Interlaken. And in 1919, the State Park Commission is established. And immediately they start sort of gathering up land and creating new parks. So by 1921, we have about a dozen parks total. and they add camping facilities. So by the mid-1920s, we're really seeing this boom in state park establishment in Michigan.
Mickey, are tin can tourists still around, and how do they define themselves?
They are. So it's an official group. It's only $20 a year to become a member, so it's pretty low entry fee. They sort of died out in the last official meeting was 1978, and then they got restarted by a high school history teacher who was fascinated by the subject, which I can imagine a lot of us would be, restarted in 1998. And mostly these days, they're vintage camper and trailer aficionados. So you'll see a lot of Airstreams, but you'll also see a lot of other interesting kinds. Like, I know one fellow who volunteers at the Ford Paquette Museum, and he is rebuilding a 1927 trailer from the blueprints that he found in Popular Mechanic magazine. So he's basically taking these, you know, 90-year-old diagrams and rebuilding this thing from scratch. So you get a lot of folks that are really passionate about both the history and the camping.
Well, Mickey, what are the tin can tourists doing for their 100th birthday?
An awful lot. All winter, they've had celebrations in Florida. And then this year, actually next week, May 18th is the official open to the public day. They're rallying at Camp Dearborn. So you can go, you can tour some of these vintage trailers and campers and check it out. And then the big official 100-year celebration is up at Interlochen State Park at the end of June. And they're planning basically 5 days of caravanning from place to place and just a real big 100th anniversary celebration up there.
So certainly if you're on the roads anywhere around Interlochen and you see this caravan of interesting vehicles, you'll know, Ben, you're seeing tin can tourists.
That's right.
Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark and historian and blogger Mickey Lyons. It's always fun talking history with you guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Domenico Grosso is wrapping up his first year as chancellor at the University of Michigan Dearborn. Let's see how the year has gone and explore his plans for U of M Dearborn's future. Cindy Canty spoke with Grosso at our Stateside Live show in Dearborn last week.
Thank you so much for making time. I'm sure it is a busy time of the year wrapping things up. How has the first year gone for you?
It's been a terrific year. Thank you very much for having me on the show. I've been so excited to join the University of Michigan Dearborn and to work with the faculty, students, and staff, and it's gone beyond my wildest expectations.
So what was the most unexpected surprise about being chancellor?
I think that there are a lot of interesting things about being in charge of a university, but about being in charge of this particular university, it's been very special because the students have been so inspirational and they are working so hard to create a new life for themselves. It's something that I have not experienced in my other institutions in terms of the transformational role that this institution is playing. And the faculty have been truly equally as inspirational.
And I know you are a first-generation college student, the son and grandson of Taylors.
Indeed.
Got your engineering degree as a commuter student at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts. So how does that personal experience inform the work you're doing as chancellor at U of M Dearborn?
Well, it informs it in a great deal of different ways, so I can really empathize with the experience that these students are having, their struggles, their challenges. And at the same time, I also see what a good education can do in terms of transforming lives. So I want to make sure that the students that are enrolled or will enroll at the university are going to have the same opportunities and experiences that I did, and even more. So I'm working as hard as I can, along with the faculty, to give them the opportunities that they deserve and that they will certainly earn.
I know that you use the Latin phrase tabula rasa, blank slate, to describe how you see things going forward. I'm taking that to mean that you feel you don't have to be stuck with the same ways of doing things. What does this approach look like in practice on campus? Do you have an example you can give us?
Well, that's a great question. We're going through a strategic planning initiative right now, and as you probably know, there's been a lot of discussion about the role of higher education in society, and it's really come under a great deal of fire. And things are changing rapidly with technology, with demographics, and with things like admissions that we've seen the scandals taking place across the country.
Still growing.
And still, indeed. So what we're looking at is, what is education going to look like in the coming century? And are we tied to the way that we've been doing things for the last century, the last multiple centuries? And we're looking at really being exciting about what we're going to do in the future. So we want to be informed by the past, but we don't want to be shackled by it. So I've charged our faculty, students, and staff to think broadly without being inhibited by how we've done things.
So uncork your creativity.
Exactly.
One solution a lot of universities have turned to is online classes and partnering with outside companies to deliver that, with some mixed results. What are your thoughts about online education?
Well, I think that there is no question that aspects of online education are not only here to stay, but are going to certainly have the ability to enhance education, and it's how it's being used. So I think that we have hybrid type of programs, we have fully online programs, we have really creative programs. There's a program that is offered by a university, a for-profit university in the Bay Area called Minerva, where they take a cohort of students and every semester is in a different international city, and they study their entire curriculum online. So there are different ways of using online education. There's the flipped classroom model, where you listen to lectures online and then come to the classroom and discuss what you've heard. Instead of going home and doing homework, you do the homework really in class with the professor. So I think that online has a lot of opportunity. It can also be misused and improperly used.
In a way that reduces the value of the degree.
Absolutely. And we've seen that as well. So we want to make sure that when we do it effectively, we do it thoughtfully, and we do it in the best interest of the student.
Do you see yourself expanding online class offerings?
Oh, absolutely. We do have online classes, and we do have online degree programs right now. We see that being an increasingly important part of our future, as many universities do.
And I know you have said you want to double the student population and increase graduation and retention rates to 70% in the next 5 to 10 years. What will it take to do that?
It's going to take us doing things differently. So I think things like online education can help in terms of remedial work or tutorial work. It's going to require us really understanding why the students are not completing at greater rates. Is it a personal thing? Is it our curriculum? Is it financial? And really intervening at the appropriate points to help them complete. And the reason I think that we should expand our student body is because the more diverse and larger our student body, the better the educational experience that our students have, and that we can contribute in a greater way to Southeastern Michigan.
There is an effort underway called the One University Coalition. It's pushing for more equitable funding among the main U of M campus in Ann Arbor and the campuses in Flint and in Dearborn. And the group argues among the disparities is in state allocated funds. U of M Dearborn and U of M Flint students get half the allocation compared to Ann Arbor students. What are your thoughts?
Well, I would rather not talk about a comparison. Mm-hmm. I would say that I would welcome an increase in our state appropriation, and I think that we would put it to good use.
Should there be a conversation about more equitable funding among the U of M campuses? What would that conversation look like to you?
The three U of M campuses have different missions, and I think that we have to consider what their roles are in serving the state of Michigan, in serving the nation, and think about how we're supporting them from a state level. And I think that we can make a very strong argument that an investment by the state in the University of Michigan Dearborn will return on its investment significantly. And I would encourage our state legislators to think about that.
When you talk about that idea of each school, each of the U of M campuses has a different mission in a sense, what's your vision of Dearborn's mission? Who are you turning out?
That's a great question. So back in the late 1800s, Justin Morrill, Senator Justin Morrill from Vermont, proposed legislation called the Morrill Land Grant Act. And we created all these great land grant universities. And these universities were points of access for the working class. And they were supposed to help the working class contribute to society in a significant way through their education. And those universities have been very important for our cultural and economic advantage throughout the last century. But as we have seen, the land-grant schools have become increasingly competitive to get into. They've been increasingly focused on research. And now regional schools, such as University of Michigan Dearborn, are a natural part of doing what the land-grant school's mission was, which is providing opportunity for the common individual. So one of the principles of the University of Michigan has been to provide an uncommon education for the common individual, and this is something we're very committed to, is providing opportunity and access to individuals that are going to contribute to society and may not have come from the privilege of some of the other students that go on to different types of institutions.
Have you had graduation yet?
We have had graduation.
So you've had a chance to look these youngsters in the eyes. They come up and give them
And I've hugged them, and I've shaken their hands, and I've taken selfies with them, and I've been very inspired by them.
Well, we want to thank you for spending time with us at this busy time. University of Michigan Dearborn Chancellor Domenico Grasso, thank you for being with us on Stateside. It's been great to meet you.
Thank you very much, Cynthia.
And events like Stateside Live, we're doing them all the time at Michigan Radio. You can find out more, follow us on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Or if you've got a story you want us to focus on, send us an email, stateside@michiganradio.org, or find us simply at the website, michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Kalamazoo is going medieval this week. The 54th International Congress on Medieval Studies begins tomorrow on the campus of Western Michigan University. Thousands of scholars from around the world will be gathering to discuss all things medieval. And that includes medieval theater, which turns out to have some stunningly modern themes. Jenna Solio-Shanks is an assistant professor of theater history at the University of Minnesota Duluth. She's bringing a hashtag Time's Up themed modern version of a medieval play to the Mostly Medieval Theater Festival in Kalamazoo. Cindy spoke with Solio-Shanks earlier this week.
When we use that term medieval, what centuries are we basically referring to?
Well, it is a large sort of swath of history. I mean, the Middle Ages ranges anywhere from the fall of the Roman Empire to the Renaissance, and it depends on where you date those things. The play that we're bringing is a 10th century play, so it falls kind of squarely in the middle of the 500 to 1500 year span.
Okay, so you're presenting a play that's called Time's Up, but it's an adaptation of a medieval play. Tell us about the original play.
So the original play goes by several titles. Some people call it Paphnutius for one of the lead characters. I like to call it The Conversion of the Harlot Thais, because that's really expressing the action of the play. It's written by a woman, the first female playwright that we have in history, and the first playwright of any gender after antiquity. And her name is Hrotsvit.
Hrotsvit.
Hrotsvit, which is quite a handle. Her name is kind of special because it means, or she translated it to mean, strong voice. So we know that Hrotsvit sort of named herself in a way that expressed her agenda or her point of view, to express something in a strong way that she felt was really important in her own day.
So what is the story of this play?
So the story comes from religious legend. It's the story that, if you're familiar with the Roman playwright Terence, you might have heard of some of these characters before. Thais is a famous harlot, a courtesan. And in this play, she is rehabilitated or converted by this man, a hermit, named Paphnutius. And so we watch this journey that she goes on with Paphnutius to change from being this fallen woman to sort of rising again through Christianity. But because we're interested in more modern points of view, and we wanted to get away from the pure sort of Christian doctrine that Hrotsvit was interested in, we've sort of pulled away from the more Christian dogma and looking at it more as a story of a woman who is trying to find herself.
And thus this production called Time's Up. So did you update the translation?
We really didn't update it so much. I mean, the original is in Latin, so the fact that it's in English, I guess you'd say, is a major change. We really didn't change the action of the characters, but any play that goes from the page to the stage goes through an interpretation. And so with my point of view, with our team's point of view, which was much more 21st century, somewhat feminist, you might say, we really didn't see the character of Thais as a sinner as much as a person who was being somewhat victimized by the circumstances around her. She's the way she's described in the play as being sort of a crime against the universe because of the way she uses her body. And that struck me as a very modern argument that we sometimes hear about women's bodies being inherently evil or inherently dangerous and needing to control them.
Or even even that term from the 21st century, that idea of, air quotes here, slut shaming.
Exactly. And I think audiences who come see this play will feel as if Thais is very much being slut shamed. And so we're not shying away from the content of the play, of showing her being abused, actually, by these men. But we are asking maybe different questions because of our 21st century lens.
And what kinds of things are you able to do? So, something tells me they didn't have a lot of stage directions in plays written in the 10th century.
Right. There are no stage directions. And that's one of the challenges. In fact, scholars have debated for hundreds of years, actually, whether or not these plays were ever staged. And that, to me, is not really the most interesting question. I feel like they suggest a lot of staging on the page, and that's where we had a lot of fun with it. So, for example, there's a scene that has three lines in it. It basically says, let's go on a journey, okay, we'll go on the journey, hey, we're here. And I said, well, this is a great opportunity to stage a journey. We don't have to talk about it. The characters don't have to describe every step of their journey, but I thought, wouldn't it be great if we could see it? And so that's what we attempted to do. And we used a lot of movement and original music, and lights become a character in and of themselves in this production. So even though it is being done at a medieval festival and it is a millennial old play, what I'm invested in is, does this play speak to modern audiences? And we were lucky enough to stage it here at the University of Minnesota, where we had wonderful audiences. So I'm pretty secure in my notion that this is a very stage-worthy play and that the action is really compelling. The fact that it's a millennial old, I think, is what makes it very interesting.
Well, when you stop and realize that you know, in the 21st century have collaborated with this woman playwright from the 10th century, has to be kind of a very cool feeling, if I may.
Yes, no, that's exactly it. And in fact, she was looking back 1,000 years before her time to the playwright Terence. And so I feel like she would very much approve of this idea of collaborating through the millennia, saying, you know, what are these universal themes? What are these problems that we're still dealing with? And obviously, people from that era would have had very different ideas about it. She certainly had a very clear Christian agenda. Our agenda is different. But I think the questions are still very worthwhile.
And what do you hear is the most central questions that is being posed by the conversion of the harlot Thais and Time's Up, your version?
That's a great question. It's something that we've really struggled with because, of course, the play doesn't really answer the question, but it does, I think, ask the question of who gets to control women's bodies. In this play, it very clearly situates the female body as the problem in the world. And I think that is something, although we may not say it quite as bluntly these days, it is often implied. And I think it's still worth us talking about where these notions come from. So if the character of Paphnutius is tormented by his feelings for Thais or by the even presence of a woman like Thais, I think it's an interesting question for us to answer of why does he feel he has the authority to constrain her? And that's really what he does in this play. He locks her up. He jails her and tortures her for her very being. And so, you know, when we talk about women in this pejorative sense of judging them by their bodies, not allowing them to go beyond traditional roles or just our traditional view of women, I think that that's something that we're still grappling with. How can we have a fair and equitable world if we actually have different rules for different genders?
Jenna, what would you say to people who hear the word medieval and think, oh, dry and unrelatable and ancient? What would surprise people most about medieval plays?
Well, first of all, I understand that reaction, and often when I teach medieval theater, I ask my students the first question, or what are the associations that you have when I say medieval theater? And after we get over the fact that there actually was theater in the Middle Ages, yes, they have all of those assumptions, that it's dry, that it's overly didactic or religious, but in fact, I think every era of theater is motivated by the same things we are. It's storytelling, it's enacted through bodies, which is inherently compelling. We love watching people go through actions. It's not about them talking to us. It's about them showing. And so they show us their world. And as I said before, this play isn't set in an earlier era. It wasn't our intention to sort of transport people back in time, and we're not looking to maintain some sort of historic practice in any way. So I think what they're going to be surprised about is how relevant, how immediate, how alive these plays seem, despite the fact that they're 1,000 years old. They're funny. There's complications in there that we still question, or essential questions, I should say, that we're still grappling with. And I think all of that makes for good theater, whether it's older theater or being written today.
And help remind us we share more than we might think with people of the 10th century.
Absolutely. There's sort of universal things that we're still struggling with.
And when are you and your actors presenting Time's Up? Is it open to the public?
It is open to the public, and we have two shows. One is Saturday night, the 11th at 8 p.m., and the second show is on Sunday, the 12th at noon.
Jenna Solio-Shanks, Assistant Professor of Theater History at the University of Minnesota Duluth, will be presenting the play that's a Time's Up-themed modern version of a medieval play at the Mostly Medieval Theater Festival in Kalamazoo. Great talking with you. We want to thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Let the game of legislative chicken begin. That's the headline from Gongware News Service's Zach Gorchow. It's his latest piece on the passage of big auto insurance changes in the state Senate. Hey, Zach.
Hey, Zoe.
So as we've reported, this thing dropped and was voted on all within one day this week. The legislation would allow drivers to purchase lower insurance coverage amounts. It would basically end unlimited medical benefits for folks injured in accidents. But you've really been thinking and writing about the political implications of this bill, because it is not happening inside a vacuum.
No, you basically have three showdowns that are brewing right now.
Dun,
and
they're
all interrelated, as major issues tend to become in Lansing. You have auto insurance, you have the budget, and you have road funding. And on all three, the Democratic governor, Gretchen Whitmer, and the Republican-led legislature are staking out very different positions and are really on a collision course.
Do you think, I mean, okay, so for Lansing reporters, astute Lansing reporters like yourself, I think most of us are trying to be like, what are they trying to do? What is the end game here, right? Do you think they even know what the end game is here?
I asked a lot of people the question yesterday who are following this issue, what is the goal here? Because this, you know, this is, if the insurance industry could have a dream bill, this would be it. And, you know, that's fine, but you have to get the governor to sign it, and she's not going to sign this type of a bill. And the consensus is they're basically going to dare the governor to veto this, that they feel auto insurance is such a potent issue with the public because of the rates continuing to climb upward, and because the governor has been pretty tight-lipped on auto insurance, it really hasn't been foremost on her agenda. She hasn't said a lot about what she would like to see happen there, that I think they feel enough is enough. They've certainly kept their powder pretty dry so far this year. They haven't gone and thrown a bunch of bills on her desk that she would reflexively dislike. And I think they're of the mind, it's time. Let's put this on her desk. If she somehow signs it, which is not going to happen, but if she somehow did, great. But otherwise, we'll use this against her. That obviously, the latter option does not accomplish the goal that I think most people have, which is to find some way to deal with rates and the rampant lawsuits and abuses that are going on in the system while still maintaining a quality of care. And it's really an answer that has eluded people for decades.
I was going to say, I mean, generations. So we did see this interesting dynamic, though, because we've all sort of been used to, under the Snyder administration, a pretty tight-lipped governor who wouldn't normally say, you remember this, whether he was going to sign or veto something. Gretchen Whitmer came out and basically said, I will veto this, right? So again, kind of staking this claim. But I want to talk about the two Democrats who voted with the Republican majority. And we have a clip. Here's Senator Adam Hollyer of Detroit speaking on the floor about why he is supporting the legislation.
A number of plans have come across and been said of, these are better options. We should do those things.
Count me in. But today I got an opportunity to lower people's rates. Is it the best plan? No. Does it still have a long way to go? Absolutely. But I believe that's what the legislative process is here for.
So what do we know about why these two Democrats voted for the legislation, and how does that play into just the swirl of politics going on here?
Both Senator Ollier and Senator Santana are on Team Duggan. They were backed by the mayor in last year's Democratic primaries. Mayor Duggan, of course, has been a big proponent of getting rid of the unlimited medical benefit and making big changes to how auto insurance handles injuries from traffic crashes. So it wasn't terribly surprising that they were going to jump on board a bill like this. Now, we haven't heard from the mayor on this bill, and I don't think that's surprising because I don't think he wants to be getting into a public battle with the governor on this right now. But, you know, look, these were two people that had the mayor's strong support because they were with him on insurance.
So where is, let's flip houses here and go to the Republican-controlled House. We have talked about this before. We have seen this movie before. Senate Republicans vote or push for auto insurance changes, and it seems to languish in the House. What are you hearing right now about House Republicans?
You know, it's funny, Zoe. There's, on the one hand, our folks who really monitor the House closely say there is still a cadre of somewhere between 8 and 12 House Republicans that are not on board with this kind of a change. This ends the unlimited medical benefit in a big way. In fact, puts a pretty strict cap, a backdoor cap, on what medical benefits would be. Historically, that has gone nowhere in the House. Now, membership, of course, has changed some, but you still have Republicans in Oakland County who have a lot of health care there and have L. Brooks Patterson, and they're going to be reticent. And you still have a lot of Republicans in Kent County who are mindful of their health care providers as well. Are a handful of Democrats who were elected again with Mayor Duggan's support who could go for this bill. But, you know, it doesn't seem like today there's enough. Now, that said, from what we're told, Senate Republican leadership and the House Republican leadership have been in a lot of communication on this. And at least the impression that the Senate Republicans have gotten is that from the House Republicans is that this is doable. And everyone seems to agree the longer the bill that passed yesterday sits in the House, the less likely it is to pass. So this was a bit of a gamble on timing to pass it now, because honestly, unless the House knows it has 56 votes ready to roll next week, this was a big mistake to pass this as soon as they did, or at least they need to get it out of the House in the next couple of weeks, because now you're going to see all the groups that don't like this bill, and are many, are going to start pounding on House members. There's going to be a mobilization of groups to lobby House members against this bill. So, you know, there's a lot riding on Speaker Chatfield here to deliver these votes, and it's unclear whether they're there.
It will be super interesting to watch next week. And then, of course, at the end of May, we have the Mackinac Policy Conference, where all the lawmakers head up to Mackinac Island and negotiations could possibly continue. And who knows what will come out of those talks.
Yeah, I mean, if this goes all the way to Mackinac and the House hasn't acted, I'd say the bill is in pretty serious trouble. It says that the votes are definitely not there because, you know, several weeks will have gone by and that the groups are able to apply the brakes. You know, something like this, like you saw what the Senate did yesterday, quick strike. There was, you know, a matter of hours between the time the content of the bill was unveiled and it passed. There was no time for groups to look at the bill and say, we've got to start pounding on senators A, B, and C and say, no, you can't vote for this. This is a problem. It was already out of the chamber.
79-page bill dropped and voted on all in one day. Zach Gorchow is with Gongware News Service. His latest is Let the Game of Legislative Chicken Begin. You can find it on the Gongware website. Zach, thanks so much for your insights.
Hey, thanks for having me, Zoe.
We'll be right back. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Bella Isaacs, Katie Raymond, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. And that's Stateside for today. I'm Zoe Clark. Thanks so much for listening.